Welcome to Future of Freedom. I'm your host, Scott Bertram. Future of Freedom is a production of America's Talking Network. You can check out all of our great podcasts at americastalking.com. To support great podcasts like this one, please donate by clicking the link in the show description. We bring you interviews today from different sides of the debate over expanded access to contraception. In a little bit, we'll be joined by Michael New, Assistant Professor of Social Research at the Bush School of Business at the Catholic University of America. First, we talk to Courtney Joslin. She is Resident Fellow and Senior Manager for the Project for Women and Families at R Street, more at rstreet.org. Courtney, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Scott.
Talking today about the discussion, debate over the expanded access to contraception. I don't know if you ask people, perhaps they'd say contraception is pretty widely available. What barriers do you see? What work still has to be done, in your opinion?
So there are a few things that those of us in the contraception policy space are focused on right now. The first is that from our sort of center-right perspective, birth control in the medical community has been seen as no longer necessary to put behind a prescription barrier for a lot of methods. So for example, as of like 5 years ago, if you wanted to obtain birth control pills, you would have to go to your doctor, get a prescription, and then go to the pharmacy to fill that. But if you look at the list of risks associated with birth control, as well as any contraindications, so things that may indicate that you shouldn't be taking a certain method, they're very few. And for those that exist, women are capable of self-assessing for those contraindications. So all of this is to say that research shows we no longer really need a prescription barrier for many birth control methods. And so one of the reforms that's been taking place over the last 5 years has been states starting to allow pharmacists to prescribe birth control. And the reason that some of these reforms are important in the first place is that there is a lack of access in some areas to birth control. Now, many of us think of access to birth control as, well, if you can go to a pharmacy or go to a doctor, how hard could it be? But research consistently shows that there are large gaps of access. So for example, those who are uninsured tend to forego contraceptive methods that are more highly effective because they require a prescription. So if you're eliminating some of that prescription barrier, you're reaching that population that can now get it without having to go to a doctor's office and incur the fees associated with that. But you see sort of a wide range of different access problems. Sometimes it's as simple as you live in a rural place and your ability to go to a doctor's office requires about an hour and a half drive one way. So looking at some of these problems that have cropped up in terms of access, that's where some of these reforms to expand access have become more popular. So as I mentioned, pharmacist prescribing is very important, as well as if we're extending the logic of, okay, birth control may not need a prescription at all in some cases, then we need to look at, on the federal side, making some methods available completely over the counter without a prescription. And this is something that, of course, we all saw happen in the news recently, with the FDA approving one brand and one version of a birth control pill called Opill that will be available on shelves for over-the-counter purchase. And so that's another one that is really important because what we've also seen in survey data is that women report having trouble getting their preferred method of birth control, and therefore they either don't get it or they spend a lot of time and money to get it that they may not have. So even though we think of things like the contraceptive mandate under the Affordable Care Act that says, you know, birth control is covered by insurance without a copay, we think, great, that means birth control is free. It's not really the case in practice.
On the issue of making it over the counter, is that truly a political issue, or is this an issue that the FDA deals with? How does the political component come into that?
Yeah, sure. So the FDA is in charge of making the decision, right, about which drugs become available over the counter. What can happen in the political sphere is that legislators can try to encourage the FDA to move on application. So as you might be able to imagine, if a drug manufacturer wants to move one of their products over the counter, the FDA says, great, here's an application process that you have to go through in order to get that status. And as you might imagine, that process is very long and it is very expensive. So a lot of companies say, you know what, we'll just leave it as it is. We'll keep it behind a prescription barrier. We don't want to front the cost for getting this drug available over the counter. So what Congress can do in this case is Congress can, if it passes in Congress, they can basically say, okay, the FDA now has to waive application fees associated with certain drugs, as well as fast track the application. So putting it at the top of the pile of everything else the FDA is dealing with. And the reason that this is being attempted now, we've seen several iterations of this in Congress over the years. The reason sometimes they do this is because there is that sort of public health aspect or even the public interest piece, right? Where if we're saying, okay, more women report having trouble getting access to birth control, then maybe we should consider fast tracking something like this for better access.
Do you worry that the promotion of birth control, the easier access to contraceptives, in some way torpedo the argument for the Republican Party or the conservative party here in the United States as being the pro-life party or the party of life?
Not at all. And this is something that I've worked with a number of state policymakers, as well as members of Congress on who are a part of the Republican Party that I've worked with them on. And their line of argument is one that I think is very admirable, which is if one wants to be pro-life, then you must consider some of the upstream ways you can even, you know, prevent the conversation of abortion. And one of those ways is by preventing unintended pregnancy through better contraceptive use. And we've seen this time and time again. The World Health Organization, for example, named contraception as one of the greatest achievements for public health in the 20th century, because what it did was it fostered an environment where women and their spouses and families were better able to plan for the families that they wanted, which then in turn led to fewer unintended pregnancies. It led to higher educational attainment for women. It led to higher earnings for women. Birth control is even associated with lower divorce rates. So there are a lot of sort of these first order and second order positive effects that came out of the availability of contraception to now, which, again, you're sort of getting to avoid some of these more unfortunate situations as you think about women in situations where they're considering abortion. If you're stopping some of that issue from, like I said, the upstream part of this, then you're preventing some of those downstream effects. And one other major piece of that is that a lot of times unintended pregnancies carry higher personal as well as just economic costs. So if someone doesn't know they're pregnant, they may not be acting as though they are. Their costs to the healthcare system are higher. So you're seeing a lot of cases where, you know, the state is paying more, but also you have higher risk and more complicated pregnancies as a result. So if the goal for, you know, a legislator or an individual is to be pro-life, applying that to helping folks avoid those situations in the long run is completely in line with being pro-life.
Talking with Courtney Joslin from R Street, where she is resident fellow and senior manager of the Project for Women and Families. There are objections to contraceptives. There are moral objections. There are some harm objections out there. Do either of those hold water with you?
They don't hold much water with me. I think that anyone can have the opinion of whether they personally want to use birth control or not. Where that should stop is your ability to tell somebody else whether they should use birth control or not. When you look at the moral acceptability of birth control, an interesting trend that we've seen is Gallup does a survey every year with Americans asking them about the moral acceptability of certain issues. And time again, birth control tops the list of morally acceptable issues. So around 90% of Americans say that birth control is morally acceptable. And this tops other issues that they ask Americans about. So this birth control beats out wearing fur, drinking alcohol, gambling, and even getting a divorce. So when you look at sort of the overwhelming percentage of Americans that support birth control use, it's harder to make the case that a moral argument should then apply to public policy, right? You can hold your own personal moral beliefs about birth control, but that doesn't mean they should apply to the population at large. And then again, back to that 90%, if you cross-section that percentage of Americans, you find that it's even high amongst folks, regardless of their marital status, regardless of their religious affiliation, regardless of demographic. You find it across all of those that birth control use is very high on the moral acceptability chart.
As you talk about the acceptance or the popularity, and if you want to call it that, of these policies, do you think that a strategic shift like this is a necessity in a post-Dobbs environment? Did that change the calculus at all?
I think policymakers in general would be very smart to latch on to better contraceptive policies in the wake of Roe being overturned and the Dobbs decision. I think what you're seeing and what we have certainly seen is that you may separate the two issues entirely, which I do for a lot of reasons, right? Abortion and contraception are they're legally different things. But what you're seeing is that after Roe, surveys showed that a lot of Americans were then confused about the legality and availability of birth control as a result. There's a lot of conflation that can happen. And so one of the things that smart policymakers have done have been passing, mostly on the state level, passing laws that are basically a right to contraception or making it clear in abortion-related restrictions that contraception is in no way part of these restrictions. And, you know, this happens a lot in any sort of policy shift. People who don't spend, you know, their 9 to 5 looking at policy changes like I do aren't necessarily concerned about, well, what does this actually mean in practice when it happens? So post-Dobbs, there was a lot of confusion, a lot of worry over the availability and accessibility. Things like emergency contraception, people started stockpiling it. So the best thing that policymakers can really do here to sort of, you know, maintain their status as being, you know, a representative of their people is they can reassure people. They can pass laws that say, we're not talking about birth control, that is perfectly safe and available. And that's going to go a long way for people who rely on these family planning methods.
You mentioned emergency contraception and Plan B, which has been available over the counter in recent years. I wonder if you know of any consequences in terms of how that has affected behavior or how that has affected, say, abortion numbers and other data points?
Sure. So in terms of behavior, what we hear a lot, in the past was that any increase to contraception will promote sexual promiscuity. And research has shown that that's never the case. Rates of engaging in sex don't go up. They especially don't go up for teenagers, which is surprising, perhaps to some. But what you see is that some of those worries haven't come to fruition. So in the case of emergency contraception, people were worried about, well, this will again increase the risk of sexual promiscuity, and it hasn't. What it's done is prevent some unintended pregnancies. And one of the major things that emergency contraception has alleviated is visits to the emergency room. Many women who find themselves in a situation where they may want to use emergency contraception, but maybe didn't have access to it or before it was available over the counter, would then end up in the emergency room in hospitals. And that number has plummeted as emergency contraception has become available over the counter. One thing we do not want to see, however, because everything tends to have, you know, good and bad consequences. One thing we don't want to see is an increase in use of emergency contraception as a regular contraceptive method. And again, this goes back to the stockpiling of emergency contraception after Dobbs, which happened in some places. Some people started to stockpile, but I worry that people will turn to that method as a primary method if they're not able to get access to a regular method for a reasonable price, which is why some of this over-the-counter reform, some of this pharmacist prescribing reform stuff is so important, so that we're making sure people have all the options on the table and can choose the actual method or option that works the best for them.
Other countries have different laws and rules and regulations, of course. Is there a success story that you might wish to point to as for another country that's taken similar steps?
Sure. So the United States is one of the few countries that doesn't have complete over-the-counter accessibility to contraception, particularly for hormonal methods like the birth control pill or the birth control patch, the vaginal ring, those sorts of things. Many, many countries have those methods available over-the-counter, or they have them, in research has shown, de facto over-the-counter. We have a tendency to be very, very cautious when it comes to any sort of healthcare policy, drug policy, right, prescription policies. But what we've seen is that there's really no need for some of that concern when it comes to birth control. And so in terms of other countries and success stories, you're starting to see some more Western European countries also open up their birth control markets. We're seeing more things like pharmacist prescribing in the UK and in Canada. But overall, we still tend to have sort of a tight grip on contraception in most of the, you know, with the OECD's like top 20 countries. You see that a lot. But the rest of the world has sort of calmed down about it and has allowed it to be over the counter. And there's been a lot of success where people tend to take it for granted that they can get access to it here because it's covered by insurance. Again, for those of us who are in, you know, maybe bigger cities or have employer sponsored health insurance, we don't consider it a big problem. But for those who are, you know, at the federal poverty level or below, or in a rural area, or any number of factors in the U.S., means that your access is not something you take for granted. So that's just one thing we have to be careful about not backtracking on. Contraceptive access has been a marker of significant economic and societal progress, and we need to make sure that our policies help foster that instead of backtracking on some of that progress.
Courtney Joslin is resident fellow and senior manager of the Project for Women and Families at R Street. You can find more at rstreet.org. Courtney, thanks so much for joining us today on The Future of Freedom.
Thank you, Scott.
Now to hear another side of the argument about expanded access to contraception, we talk with Michael New, assistant professor of social research at the Bush School of Business at the Catholic University of America. Michael, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me. Much appreciated.
We're talking today about the possibility of policies that would expand access to contraception, make it easier to access for some Americans. I want to ask first, because you've written previously about the idea of a culture of life, and I'm curious if you think that there is a place at all. Where, how do you see contraception at all in that vision, even in some transitory period, so to speak?
I really don't think contraception has any role in building a culture of life. You know, I think that essentially to really have a meaningful culture of life, the culture has to be more chaste. Contraceptives do not result in a more chaste culture. They result in a more promiscuous culture. So I think that the idea of contraception really contradicts any efforts to really build a culture of life.
With current status quo, you have things like emergency contraception, like Plan B, that are available over the counter, but not, say, the birth control pill. If that is status quo, would it be better for something like the birth control pill to be available over the counter to prevent the usage of Plan B, or perhaps at least decrease the usage of something like Plan B?
I don't think so. I think most of the research out there that shows that efforts to make contraception more widely available tend to be either ineffective at best or counterproductive at worst. You know, I think that if you start making contraception available over the counter, it's going to be used by a lot of teenagers. Teenagers may not use it correctly, and I think you're just going to result in more sexual activity, more conceptions, and I think tragically more abortions.
When you talk about there not being a place for contraception in a culture of life, I'll phrase it this way. I'm curious, how much of that is a moral objection, and how much of that is, say, a harm objection, that use of contraception sort of actively harms young people or just women in general?
I'll say a couple of things. I mean, I have a background in political science. I do quantitative social science work. So I come at this from the perspective you know, of someone who's interested in the data. I'm not a theologian. I'm not a bioethicist. I am just interested in getting abortion numbers down and pursuing strategies that will effectively reduce the abortion rate. And I don't think more access to contraception will do that. And there's a couple reasons for this. First, you know, contraception has a failure rate. Guttmacher, in 2014, they said that 51% of all abortion patients in the U.S. were using some kind of contraceptive the month they became pregnant. So contraceptives aren't fail-proof. When they do fail, obviously, when they become pregnant, and very often they choose abortion as a backup. That's one thing. Secondly, you know, right now, we really don't have any kind of a contraception crisis in the United States. Contraceptives are available. Women who want to get contraceptives can usually do so. In 2002, Guttmacher did a study of about 10,000 women who are sexually active and who are not using contraceptive. They found that only 12% said either cost or availability as a reason why they were not using contraception. Most women who don't use contraception either want to show trust in a partner or just are willing to run the risk of getting pregnant. It's usually not cost or availability. So in 2012, CDC did a study of 5,000 teenage girls who gave birth. Only a very small percentage said they had trouble accessing contraception. So again, contraception is covered by Medicaid programs. I think low-income women can sort of get contraceptives that are free or subsidized through Medicaid. So again, you know, I don't see situations where pushing contraceptives is going to really do all that much to get contraceptive use rates up. Additionally, and I can talk about this more, most of the research on programs that either encourage or promote or subsidize contraceptives shows these programs are either ineffective at best or counterproductive at worst. And I can talk about that more later on.
Yeah, I want to ask about that actually specifically here. President Obama had something called the Teen Pregnancy Prevention Program. So that specifically, if you have data or efforts like that, do we see that in the end they are effective? There's a lot of critique about the DARE program, right, from the 80s when it came to drug use, and people said that was just not effective at all. We thought it was at the time, but it turns out it wasn't. Are programs like the Teen Pregnancy Prevention Program at all effective in achieving their goals?
No, they were not. Interestingly, you know, anytime there is a program that essentially gives out grant money, there's an evaluation process. President Obama's own HHS evaluated the Teen Pregnancy Prevention Program and found that like a very tiny fraction of these programs, less than 10%, and probably even less than that, had any success at actually reducing teen pregnancy rates. Again, these are programs that were really kind of built around encouraging and promoting contraceptive use. And, you know, again, they studied over 50 of these programs, and a very small percent enjoyed any success either reducing teen sexual activity or, more importantly, reducing the teen pregnancy rate. They had some success in terms of kids are more knowledgeable about certain kinds of STIs. That might not be a bad thing. But again, Obama's own HHS, you know, who had a vested interest in trying to make these programs look good, concluded that by and large, they were a failure at getting teen pregnancy rates down.
So what works? I mean, what policies or what programs will work to get to the goal that you've already explained to us during this conversation?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, I think that, you know, as far as programs go, most of the programs just don't have a great track record of success. We do know that if we're going to get teenagers to be less sexually active, it helps if they're raised in a two-parent family. It helps if the parents have expectations that they, you know, won't be sexually active as teenagers. It helps if they go to church. It helps if they're kind of peer groups are not sexually active. You know, we know that. And we also know that, you know, teen sexual activity is not somehow inevitable. Both National Survey of Family Growth and Youth Risk Behavior Survey both show consistent declines in teen sexual activity since the late 80s, early 90s. Percentage of teens who are sexually active kind of peaked in the late 80s, early 90s, and has fallen pretty steadily ever since. You know, I think that the, you know, Youth Risk Behavior Survey shows that since the early 90s, about, you know, 20 percentage point reduction in the number of teenage boys who are sexually active, and about a 10 percentage point reduction in the percentage of teenage girls who are sexually active. So again, the reasons for this decline are going to be debated, but it does show that, you know, real progress can be made and that, you know, there are things that can be done to reduce the rates of teen sexual activity.
I don't want to make the assumption, so I will ask, there are proposals that would simply create an over-the-counter availability of contraception. There are proposals out there too that would actually subsidize those methods and actually expand the efforts to get them in the hands of women who request them. Are you opposed to those kind of efforts as well?
Yeah, again, I don't think contraception should be available over the counter. You know, I think that if a woman is going to use oral contraceptives, she should go to a physician. Then again, I think that, you know, I don't think that putting these contraceptives in the hands of teenagers is a good idea. Again, I think teenagers, there's a good chance they won't use them correctly or consistently. And I think that it will enable a lot of sexual activity that's going to result in more pregnancies and more abortions later on. And you know, we've seen evidence of this elsewhere. There's been good research on condom distribution programs in the 1990s. In the 1990s, the big fad was condom distribution. If we get condoms in the hands of high school students, you know, teen pregnancies will go down. Two Notre Dame economists have looked at this, and they found that program was ineffective. In fact, the schools and school districts that used condom distribution programs had actually increases, or at least above average incidence of teen pregnancies than those that didn't. Another interesting study back in the mid-2000s, because of a common mistake in the way a budget was passed, birth control pills on college campuses were no longer subsidized. So there's actually a big increase in the price of birth control pills for college students. What happened? College students were less likely to use birth control, but also college student sexual activity declined, and college-age women reported fewer sexual partners. There was no significant increase in pregnancies to college-age women. In Great Britain, you know, during the financial crisis between 2009 and 2014, they had to cut back spending on sex education programs that included, you know, funds for contraception. When money was cut back, they actually saw a decrease in teen pregnancy rates and teen abortion rates. So again, I think, again, there's really good data out there that shows very clearly that anytime you promote or expand access to contraception, again, it's either ineffective at best or counterproductive at worst.
This kind of policy generally is popular if you look at opinion polls. And I ask what I admit is a purely utilitarian type question, which is, if passing a policy that would expand access and make it easier for contraception access follows that voters are more likely to vote for Republicans, more likely to vote for perhaps pro-life candidates, which in turn leads to more pro-life laws in states across the country or in Washington, tightening abortion laws in perhaps some states or some areas. Is that a trade-off that makes sense that you might be willing to make?
Personally, that's not a trade-off I'm willing to make. You know, I'm not a political consultant. I don't advise people typically running for office. I would just say that, you know, contraception as a program, you know, especially the pro-life community, is polarizing and is divisive, especially among the pro-life base, especially among Roman Catholic pro-lifers. I would say that if you really want to unify people in terms of, you know, helping women, I would talk about the great work being done by pro-life pregnancy help centers, you know, that are seeing, you know, close to 1 million women every year and providing hundreds of millions of goods and services. I think that, you know, pushing contraception, you know, in ways could be harmful. That could upset part of the pro-life base. And it's not a tactic I'd recommend that pro-life candidates use.
Michael New is Assistant Professor of Social Research at the Bush School of Business at the Catholic University of America. Michael, thank you so much for joining us today on Future of Freedom.
Thanks for having me. Much appreciated.
We thank both of our guests for joining us, Courtney Joslin, who is resident fellow and senior manager of the Project for Women and Families at R Street, more at rstreet.org, and Michael New, assistant professor of social research at the Bush School of Business at the Catholic University of America. For additional episodes of the Future of Freedom podcast and other fine podcasts from America's Talking Network, check out americastalking.com or anywhere you find your audio. Thank you for listening to Future of Freedom, presented by America's Talking Network.